Our topic for consideration today is called Bible Orienteering. Now, unless you've been a Boy Scout leader or a Boy Scout, you probably don't know what orienteering means. But we're going to describe and explain for you what orienteering is and show you what we think is a biblical application as well. Now, cartography is the process of building a map, and orienteering is the process of using a map. And so we're going to look at how you actually use a map. The reason this came up a number of years ago, I was a scout leader, and I would teach orienteering merit badge. And this is basically map and compass and how to follow the lay of the land and follow a course. And we found many very apt pictures here to the things that we see in the Bible. We're going to explain that as we go along. So when we talk about map orienteering, it uses symbols, directions, distances, and waypoints. Now, when we talk about Bible orienteering, it uses symbols, directions, distances, and waypoints. So you see there's a very close association here. Let's see how this works. Now, if I was to teach you an orienteering class, the first three things I have to teach you about a map is scope, scale, and symbols. And until you understand these things, you can't even start to read the map. So these are the basis for then interpreting the map and figuring out where you are. So this is key to our understanding, that we understand these three things. Now, given a natural map, we would say, well, here's a map. What's the scope of this map? This is a map of the Persian Empire. That's the scope. It's not worldwide, and it's not the old city of Jerusalem. The scope is the kingdom or the empire of Persia. Next, we would look at the scale, and commonly we would see the scale on the bottom of a map. And a scale, you'll notice, is in multiple different increments. So whatever our preference is or our understanding, it's in kilometers and miles and in feet. And this is important so that we know, based on the scope of the map, some of the distances involved. And the last thing that we have to understand as a prerequisite to reading a map is the symbols. And you'll see many of the common symbols here that we might see on a normal map. So you might see legends for an on-road or off-road pavement, trails, streams, and so on and so forth. And we would have to understand these symbols so when we see them on the map, the words aren't there on the map, that we would understand what was being meant. Now, once we've mastered what the scope, scale, and symbols are, now we can start the orienteering process. And this really we would call navigation. And we have to start with a starting and an ending point. We orient our map, or we turn it in the direction of travel so that the map matches reality. Along the way, we look for waypoints that we should be seeing, and that gives us a confirmation. And finally, we get to the end point and the realization of where we want it to be. So the first part is to establish what the start and finishing points are. And as we learned in Boy Scouts, you can't always travel in a straight line, so you might have to take a trail that curves around a mountain or goes around a lake or a swamp. But still, we establish our start and finish points, and then we figure out how to navigate between. Next, we orient the map, and this means simply turning in the map in the orientation of what we're seeing around us. So if the road is going straight out in front of us, we turn the map until the road is going straight out in front of us, and also we're looking in the right direction on the map. Finally, along the way, we are looking for waypoints. So we might have a mountain that we would see. That's a waypoint. We would see we're going around this mountain. We see the other mountain to the left. We might have other waypoints, including streams and other roads and so forth. And finally, we get to our destination, the realization. And now we see what it's really like to be there. Now, map orienteering, basically we determine the starting and ending point. We orient the map. We set our expectations. As we go along, we observe progress, and we also adjust for realities. Now, we're in the 21st century, so most of us now probably have GPSs. And they probably automatically do this. They adjust the orientation so you see where you are on the road. You see the roads go by. You see the street you're supposed to turn on up ahead. It's doing it for you. But it's the same process. Let's look at Bible orienteering. Now, first we have to get an understanding of the symbols in God's map. And the first thing we've got to understand, just like the regular map, is scale. In Numbers 14:34 it says, after the number of days in which you search the land, even 40 days, each day for a year, ye shall bear your iniquities, even 40 years. And ye shall know my breach of promise. And so what's really key here is we're getting an association between what? Days and years. And the scriptures are giving us. Is this the only place that this association is given to us? Well, absolutely not. In Exodus 4:6 we read, thou shalt bear the iniquity of the house of Judah 40 years. Keep that in mind. He says 40 years. And I have appointed thee each day for a year. So here again, we have this association linking years and days, saying that the symbolic days that you had are now going to be represented in years. The next thing that we have to understand is the Jewish calendar. And the Jewish calendar is described as a solar lunar calendar. And what that means, a lunar calendar just follows the moon, irregardless of the cycles, and doesn't really track with the year. But the solar lunar calendar, on an annual basis, makes some adjustments so that it stays aligned with the solar calendar. And so in the solar lunar calendar, in general, we have 12 months. They each have 30 days, the cycle of the moon, and that leads to 360 days per year. Another important thing that we have to understand in God's, these are some of the scale that God gives us. He talks about times and seasons. In Joshua 3:15 it says, it's the time of the harvest. And that occurred once a year. In Leviticus 26:5 it talks about the time of the sowing. How often did that happen? Once a year. In Numbers 13:20 he talks about, now is the time of the first ripe grapes. That occurs once a year. Okay? So very specific. So showing us, when he's talking about times, he's talking about an annual event. It occurs with regards to a year. In Leviticus 25:50 we read, shall be according to the number of years, according to the time. So in this Leviticus scripture, he's giving us an equality. He's saying, if I'm speaking symbolically, a year is a time. And there are other examples as well. So we see what we have when we're talking about a time. We're talking about an annual period. And that is what? 360 days by the Jewish rendering. In 2 Peter 3:8 we read, according to New American Standard, but do not let this one fact escape your notice, beloved. He's talking to those that are listening, his beloved, that with the Lord, one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. Can he make it any clearer? He gave it to you both ways, forwards and backwards. He's stressing the importance of this. And he's saying, so from the Lord's perspective, a day is as a year. He's giving us another clue. So we have an equivalency of days, one day, to being 1,000 years. And in Psalm 90, verse 4, New International, we read, for 1,000 years in your sight, this is the Lord, are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. So he's saying it's just an instant. But once again, he's reaffirming this period that he has given us. And this is from God's perspective. So when we look at prophetic periods from God's perspective, when he's giving us that perspective, the clue is a day for 1,000 years. So let's look at our Bible scale that we've investigated. In general, a day equals a year. There's In a week, there are 7 days, so that would be 7 years. In a month, there would be 30 days, okay, or 30 years. And in a year or a time, 360 years. And so we see very clearly, and now we have our scale. You see, we're almost ready to read our Bible map because we understand the scale now, and now we can apply it. And there's a supplemental scale. That a day with the Lord is as 1,000 years. Now let's look at just an overview of chronology. In chronology, there's a number of methods to use to figure periods and so forth in chronology. And in some, we have starting and ending points only defined. And those are things like the double. So we got starting and ending points, and we have to interpret. In some, we have a starting point with a period. And those are things like the 490, 1260, 1290, 1300, 35, 300. So you got a starting point. You know the distance. So you know where you should end up. Okay, you see the difference in the two. And then we've got some with a starting point, and then what is described as cycles. And we've got that with the creative days. We've got that with the harvest. We've got that with the Jubilee. Now, for the scope of this talk, our focus is going to be on the first two. There's not enough time, as you're going to see, for us to cover all of it. So we're going to focus in on the first two in this scope of this. And we're going to look at lots of prophetic periods. Now, here's a topographical map. This is via GPS. And I love the way a GPS works because it gives you longitude and latitude and distances. And it does basically waypoints along the way. You can think of it like breadcrumbs. And so it's giving you marks along the way. When we look at Bible, our Bible map, guess what? We've got a very similar thing going on. We have starting and ending points, and we've got crumbs along the way. And so we see that these are almost like GPS coordinates. They're giving us coordinates and directions and distances. And what we're saying is if you understand the scope and the scale and the symbols, then you can understand what lies ahead and be assured of what's already passed. Two real important uses of chronology to give us an assurance that what we're understanding is absolutely true. But also it gives us the ability to look forward to things that may yet be future and realize where we are along the way and how close it might be at hand. In Matthew 24:3, according to Rotherham, we read, "The disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be, and what will be the sign of your presence and the conclusion of the age?" Now, you remember in a map, you not only have these data points, but you also had events. You had symbols of what was going to happen. And so we see both of these components right here, laid out in Matthew 24. And so it's saying, in order to get the big picture, you've got to look at all of it. You not only know the mathematical part of it, but you also have to understand the symbols. Remember, first off, I talked about cartography versus orienteering? Most of us are orienteers. There are a few out there that are cartographers, and they're dealing with the times and the seasons and the specific dates and some of those things. But for most of us, this is a roadmap that we're using. We're not building the map. We're using the map. And that's going to be kind of the spirit of as we continue to go through some of these periods. We're assured in John 16:13, Jesus tells us he will show us the things to come. You believe that? Part of the way you understand that is to look at the symbols and the signs and the times. So it requires both components, just like a map. If you had a map with the endpoints, but no symbols along the way, you wouldn't know where you were. Conversely, if all you had is the waypoints and you didn't know the start and the end, well, you would be very uncertain on when you were going to get there. It takes both in order to understand a roadmap, and it takes both to understand the signs and the seasons. So what do we do with Bible orienteering? Well, we determine the starting and ending point. We orient the scriptures in the right way. We get things lined up so we're seeing in the right way. We set our expectations of things past, things present, and things future. We observe our progress along the way, and that really confirms for us whether we're on the right track or not. And then along the way as well, and when we get there, we adjust for reality. Let's see how that works. There's the prophecy of the double. In Isaiah 40, verse 2, we read, "Jerusalem, she hath received of the Lord's hand double for her sins." Two portions. And that's the word kepel, which means not just portions, but something that's folded in half. And that's a real key clue here. Because if it's folded in half, what is the first part? It's equal to the second part. And that's very key. So when he says they're folded in half, now we know that we have two equal periods. And the blessing started in Genesis 49:28, with the 12 tribes of Israel. Their father spake unto them, and he blessed them. That was really the start of the 12-tribe nation. Going down to Matthew 23:38, the desolation period, your house is left unto you desolate. And so we have that period. Because we know that's a period of a half, we can do the math, so we go from Jacob's death to Jesus' death, and then we can fold it forward. How can we do that? We understand the symbol. We understand it is one half. And 3.5 years later, what? The Jews were left in desolation until 1878, a very key time, Pentateuch. And the first semblances of regathering. And so we see this works just wonderfully. So we can see on the Bible map how it makes sense. They started as a nation. They became desolate. They could no longer worship in the temple. It was destroyed. And then they were desolate in a period until their regathering. That's Israel's religious double. So as we look at that, we see Israel was blessed, and then Israel was left desolate. Spiritual favor was removed. They were out literally in the wilderness. Let's look at secular Israel's double. And this one, we're going to work at a little differently. We know when they became a nation, and we know when they became a nation a second time. So since we know there's two halves, if you divide that period in two, you come up with 68 A.D. This is really their dispersion from the land. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, no, it was 70 A.D., Brother Bob. Let's look at what happened in 68 A.D. So this is their secular identity as a nation. This is Vespasian's campaigns in 68 A.D. So he is in the process of taking over and coming in and routing the Jews. This is what was occurring in 68 A.D. There was a pause. Nero died. And for a period of over a month after Nero died, everything stopped. Now, if you were a Jew in this area and you saw it being ravaged and you saw the writing on the wall, this period was your period to get out. Because when they destroyed Jerusalem in 70 A.D., they killed everyone that was there. There was no opportunity for escape. So this pause gave the Jew a chance to escape. And this occurred in 68 A.D. And it nicely lines up with our observations. So now we have Jewish nationhood from a secular standpoint. The nation is dispersed. And the nation is reestablished. We're looking at the map. We're not so much looking at the numbers here. We can't lose track. You know, both are important, but it's important that we get there and that we understand how we're getting there along the way. In Leviticus 26, 17 and 18, we read, "And I will set my face against you, and you shall be slain before your enemies. They shall hate you and shall reign over you, and ye shall flee when none pursueth you, And if ye will not for all his, and if ye will not yet for all this hearken unto me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sin. A period of seven times. Remember our scale? Seven times 360 is 2,520 years. And so let's see how this works. The end of the period of the kings. So now they're under Gentile dominion. And when did that end? 2,520 years later, the end of Gentile times in 1914. How nicely that lines up. That was the period of Gentile dominion, exactly as was prophesied. All of these things should give us confidence in these things that we read. And even if we can't understand every jot and tittle of the chronology behind it, it should give us confidence in God, because what he has spoken has come true. And so we see Gentile dominion once again established and then eliminated. Next we look at the 70 weeks in Daniel 9:24. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon the holy city to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. What does it mean? Well, once again, we apply our scale, 70 weeks, 7 years to a week, 490 years. Continuing in Daniel 9:27, he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. Did the Jew understand the 70 weeks of prophecy? They did. And we know they did because they were in anticipation of who? The Savior. They were in anticipation. They knew it was about the right time period. So they understood this. And so it was 69 weeks down to Messiah, 29 AD, out of a total of 70 weeks of favor. That last week is how many years? Seven. It says that they're going to have a covenant for a week, but in the midst of it, the sacrifice and oblation shall cease. And so we see the sacrifice and oblation ceasing at the time that he left them desolate, the first 3.5 years being Christ's ministry, favor continuing for the Jews for another 3.5 years down to Cornelius, and then it being opened up from there. And so we see here again, once again, a prophecy with regards to the Jews from the rebuilding of Jerusalem to exclusive favor being removed. Next, we look at the 2300 days in Daniel 8, 13, and 14. How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgressions of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, unto 2300 days. Then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Let's see how this works. Well, what was going to happen? First, the daily offerings were to be broken. The sanctuary was to be cleansed, was the second thing. In 1 Corinthians 3:16, we read, "Know you not that ye are the temple of God?" What this is saying is that the application on the other end is to his spiritual temple. What happened there? Let's look at the 2300 days. From the rebuilding of Jerusalem to the sanctuary class being cleansed, 1846. Not a very prominent date in history, but there is something that happened that was interesting on that date. And what we expect would be a separation of this sanctuary class. What happened in 1846? Well, the Evangelical Alliance was founded in 1846. And this is a way of kind of bringing back together all the different Christian denominations into one common creed. One acceptable common creed that they could all... And this is their logo today. They exist even to this date. They had a couple of tenets that the true church could absolutely not abide by. Tenet number three, the unity of the Godhead and the Trinity of persons therein. That was repulsive to the church. It rejected fundamental doctrine. It was not acceptable. And the second was number eight, the immortality of the soul. And so you see that the true church would have to depart from any alliance or association with these church systems that were starting to embrace this false theology. They could no longer stay with these systems. So we see here a sanctuary class separation occurring in 1846. Continuing, we have the Daniel 12 time prophecies. And we read in Daniel 12:9, "Go thy way, Daniel, for thy words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end." Now, if you read many of the earlier works from the 1800s on this, there was a lot of confusion. The periods that he lists are 1260, 1290, and 1335. What do these have in common? Well, an individual called Eliot in 1852, for the first time, published a chronology where all of these started on the same date. And that was key. That was picked up by Storer and Barber and Russell as well, so it was passed down. It made sense. This was one of the keys that helped unlock these time features at the end time. And so we have three periods that are interrelated and that start at the same point in time. So what happened in 539? Well, there was a lot of problems. Remember, the Roman Empire was shifting to Constantinople. It was going into the area that we now know as Turkey. And so the stronghold of Italy was very much in flux. And the Ostrogoths, one of the tribes there, had taken over a lot of the area. Justinian, a Roman general, was sent in to, the Vandals had come in. We all know what that word Vandal means. And Justinian, a Roman general, was sent in to purge them. He used the Ostrogoths, another tribe, to do that. Well, he was recalled, and then the Ostrogoths became a problem, and Belisarius was sent in later to evict them. In 539, he was recalled. That left a power void, and what was resulted was what we know as the papal system. Papal Rome began at that time. Very small and modest beginning. But nonetheless, power was turned over to them to help rule that area. Let's see about the 1260 days. Now, this is a marvelous prophecy because we have it given in so many different scriptures. It's given to us in years, in times, and half a time, and it's given to us in months as well. And all of these relate to that same period. And this was a period when papacy would dominate and that the holy people would be in a wilderness condition. Let's look at the 1260 years. So we have the roots of papacy stretching forward to 1799. What happened in 1799? Well, the Pope died in captivity. And it was also the ending year of the declared papal millennium. And even in Catholic books, it's known as the low point in the Catholic Church. Because when the Pope died in captivity, a successor was not allowed to be appointed. And so their power was shown to be false. So, we look at when papacy was set up until papacy was broken. And it was broken in everyone's eyes. Next, we look at the 1290 days, and it says, "They shall pollute the sanctuary of strength and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate." And we know of this as the Mass. In Daniel 12, verses 9 through 11, we read, "The words are closed up and sealed until," when? "The time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried. But the wise shall understand, and from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that maketh desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. How many years? 1,290 and 90 years. What we're told here is that the wise would understand. And so if we want to be a part of that wise class, we should be kind of tuned into this. Once again, even though we may not be able to describe all the details, we should have the concept, we should have heart assurance that this has come true. So we look at it, papacy's roots in 539, papacy's low point, or rather pointing forward to 1829, and that was the time of not only the start of the Miller movement, but also a number of the Bible aids, the concordances and the dictionaries and so forth, that were so critical to causing a real fervency among those that wanted to study the Bible. And so we see this early movement where people were very interested, once again, in getting back to the Scriptures. And so what we see over this period was a period of enlightenment. And that's really what this period was all about. And so we look here and we go, a period of enlightenment from the papacy being set up until this period when Bible aids and the Miller movement really started. In Daniel 12:1, we read, "At that time shall Michael stand up." What happens when Michael stands up? He assumes power. In Daniel 12:12, we read, "Blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1,335 days." How many years is that? 1,335 years. When did it start? The same time. In Matthew 21:9, we read, "As Jesus entered triumphantly into the old city, Hosanna to the Son of David. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." Now you'll notice there's some common things. It's blessed is he that cometh. So we have him in his first triumphant entry in a natural sense, and we have him returning triumphantly in 1874. That same blessed one. And those that were watching and waiting saw him come. The Lord returns to power. And that's the important thing here. So he returns to a status of power. Let's see how that works. So we go to papacy's roots and we go forward to 1874, the Lord's return. And it's a return to power. So we add that to our chart. So now you have it. All of those many time prophecies, all of those routes, the waypoints, the signs, the times, the seasons, and we see the importance. These are our Bible waypoints. And you know, every one of them that we pointed to, we can confirm with history. We can confirm 1948. It's an absolute fact. They became a nation. We know when they ceased becoming a nation. And so many of these things are actually borne out in history as well. And this should bolster our confidence in what the Lord has prophesied. He will deliver. His percentage is 100%. Let's look at the prophecies for natural Israel. These are those. And these were exclusively for natural history. But we can see them as well and let them bolster our faith in God. You know, faith is based on things that are past that we can affirm. And that gives us an assurance for things that are yet to come. And then we can add in the component for spiritual Israel. And what we see here is very interesting. We see, especially with the Daniel prophecies, papal power rises, seemingly squashing the true church. We see a gradual level of enlightenment that occurs over a period. And then convening with Bible aids and the Miller movement, why was that necessary? Because when he returned, there had to be those watching and waiting, and if they hadn't been enlightened, they wouldn't have been there. So this should bolster our faith in these things. And you see the beautiful logical progression. God was saying, I'm going to let papacy seemingly have its run, and then I'm going to prove them false. Then over time, there'll be enlightening, and there'll be a people that will be called out so that they can be watching and waiting when I return. And they, and only they, will see this invisible second presence of the Lord. I don't know about you. I find that exciting. This is kind of an overview of God's map for us. This is Bible orienteering. Now we see God's plans and purposes being fulfilled. And so as we saw the nation of Israel become established in 1948, that should give us confidence. Because we have faith on the things that He's assured us, and He's exactly right. And therefore, we can have faith on the things yet to be seen. Now, there's one important thing that we have to do, and that's adjust for reality. And the pastor himself did this as well. In the foreword of the third volume, we read, "We are free to say that the restoration of Israel has not been accomplished as rapidly as we had anticipated. Nevertheless, we should be watching and waiting in an expectant attitude." Did he adjust for the reality? Absolutely. No one will doubt that. Continuing in reprint 5950, "Some of us were quite strongly convinced that the harvest would be ended by now. But our expectation must not be allowed to weigh anything against the facts." You know what that's saying? Look out. Look at the reality. If it doesn't line up, then maybe our expectations weren't exactly right. The fact is that the harvest work is going grandly on and is not ended by any means. He adjusted for reality. "We imagined that the harvest of gathering the church would be accomplished before the end of the Gentile times, but nothing in the Bible said so." So our thought was purely by inference. We thought that would be bundled in with 1914. And now we see that it was an unjustified one. He adjusted for reality. 1916, he writes, "In fact, we may be here a year or two or possibly more before the kingdom is fully set up. And that's not disappointing because the Lord's people are finding so many opportunities for service at their hands, hearts, and their heads are fully engaged, laboring on this side of the veil." You agree with that? Well, it's been more than a year or two. But I think our attitude and expectation should be exactly what's stated here. We just changed the period. What would he say today? As we approach the destination, what's more important, the map or the reality? That's a question each of us has to ask. What's most important? The reality. So look up and see what's happening around us. The kingdom has not yet been fully established, but it's at the door. It will be fully established shortly. We're going to see a lot of exciting things very shortly. He says for us, "And when these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads." Why? "For your redemption draweth nigh." He's saying, have a sense of urgency. Because you see these things. You're looking up. You know where we are on the stream of the time. We're at the end, the very end of the harvest. So look up. Pay attention. What we learned along the way. We learned that really these things are a foundation for our faith. This confirms our enlightenment because he says the wise will see. That gives us assurance of God's promises. And we can see the many facets and the many ways that he looked at his plans because this is not a one-dimensional chronology that we've looked at. It's many aspects. And he was dead on in every single one of them. So what it should give for us is a sense of urgency. So the question is, when are we? In Romans 8:19, it tells us exactly when we are. "For the earnest expectation of the creation waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God." It's waiting on you, and it's waiting on me. But we're one heartbeat away from that kingdom. We thank our Heavenly Father, for from Him and through Him and to Him are all things. To God be the glory forever. Amen.